Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for coming and for participating in these 2 days of what I understand have been very, very interesting, stimulating conversations. My name is Catherine Mueller. I'm a PhD in Aboriginal History from Queen's University, and I now work in university advancement here at McGill, where I also did a postdoc before I uncovered this really fun and intellectually stimulating career that I had absolutely no idea existed about 6 years ago. So I've really been delighted to be involved in this topic of Alt-AC careers over the past few years, thanks to the great work and the great people at iPlay, of course. And while I couldn't make it yesterday, I read with interest the feedback from your table sessions this morning. And clearly this is a really exciting time. There's lots of innovative thinking and inclusion of diverse programs and perspectives across disciplines, which is also why I've really been looking forward to this panel this afternoon. Mentorship, connections with PhDs who've made it outside the academy, creative career opportunities and diversification all seem critical to reimagining the PhD. And now we have an opportunity to hear from some at the forefront of the very public face of the humanities. So I'll introduce each one of our panelists very quickly, but I'll really leave it to them to tell you how their PhD helped or didn't propel them in their current career. Then we'll have about 15 minutes of a moderated discussion, followed by 15 minutes at the end for questions. So I'll start here with Roberta. Roberta Cocchi-Santoro is a MITACS postdoctoral fellow in European Studies at the University of Guelph. Her MITACS postdoc is co-funded by the Office for Cultural Policy at the City of London. In April 2013, Roberta obtained a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Western Ontario. Next to Roberta, we have Kyle Wyatt, who is originally from Nebraska. Kyle earned his doctorate from the University of Toronto, where he won the ASP Woodhouse Prize for Best Dissertation with Cartographers as Critics, Staking Claims in the Mapping of American Literature. He has served as a managing editor of The Walrus, Canada's most celebrated, one of my favorite, magazines, since June of 2011. Next to Kyle, we have Joe Medjuk, who's a film producer. And for those of you who know and love Ghostbusters, Kindergarten Cop, Old School, Dave, his favorite, Hitchcock, the list goes on and on. Joe is originally from Fredericton, New Brunswick, and came to McGill for his BA in Honors English before going on to complete an MA and a PhD at U of T, where he taught some of the very first courses on film before moving to Hollywood. And next to Joe, we have Greg Kelly, who is the executive producer at CBC Ideas. Greg holds a PhD in English from Oxford and decided not to pursue an academic career when he got Shirk funding for a postdoc at Stanford. He instead returned to Toronto, where he proofread for Harlequin before making a successful pitch to Ideas. So without any further ado, I will pass it over to Greg to get us started.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I'm just going to go home now. It's not going to get better than this. Can we hear me all right at the back there? That's okay? Yeah, okay, great. I've decided, though, after this morning's activities that I'm switching to a career in dance because it's more stable than a career at the CBC. I'm going to start with the very moment when I knew, I'm going to step in my coffee again. I'm going to start with the moment when I knew that I was not going to pursue an academic career. My Paul on the road away from Damascus moment came at Oxford University, Hartford College, in the stairwell leading up to the open-faced mailbox. They called them pigeonholes, and they were divided alphabetically. So my last name is Kelly, so I was looking at the K box. I was just about to finish the doctorate, and I had applied for a postdoc at Stanford, and was awaiting the news. And it was a very funny hallway, psychologically speaking, to be in, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do in any crystal clear terms. So I was expecting news from the Shirk, and it was the summertime. Oxford is blissfully quiet at that point. No undergraduates running around getting loaded and bothering everybody, and you could get actual work done. And so I came into the gates of the college and turned left and started to go up the stairs, and I saw it. You probably know, at least back then, going back quite a ways, that when you get a no, it's in a normal-sized envelope. When you get a yes, it's a package. And in the K box right in front of me up the stairs was the package. And I stood frozen on the stairs, and I felt just incredibly flat inside. Like, I should have been jumping out of my skin. I should have been, you know, going out into the quadrangle, and going onto the streets, and bothering everybody with this news. And I just stood there, and I couldn't make sense. I was actually a little bit frightened. I'd never had that sensation before. It was a very odd, arresting, but not joyful, nor depressing. It's not like somebody died. It was just this zero, like a real absence of sensation more than anything else. So I did my homework and looked inside, looked outside, and had had enough of fear. And I think it breaks down in a few ways. I ended up giving the postdoc back to Stanford. I tried to defer for a year. I knew they would say no. Actually, sure, said no, rightfully. I gave it back to them. And I was actually fine with that. I was tired of the fear that if I didn't get an academic job, I would develop the intellectual equivalent of this grotesque beer belly, and I would never think interesting thoughts again, and I'd become as dull as some of the people I grew up with in a small town in southern Ontario that I won't name. Cobourg, Ontario is where I'm from. And this fear had a couple of other siblings. One was the fear of finishing. You had to find 2 minutes to find yourself by fear for so, by a process that the actual prospect of finishing might mean the finishing of one's own self. Fear of a herd mentality. Back then, theory was so big in literature, and I didn't have an argument against the content or any one school of thought, but what I didn't like was the uncritical acceptance of a way of writing and reading that frankly was boring me to tears by that point. So in 3 short years, I went from Foucault to fuck you, and I decided to give it back. I'm out of there. And I said earlier, I opted for the stability of a career in broadcast journalism. So, which has been enormously fulfilling in many ways because you do get reach, you get impact, you get intense reactions. Some people call you on it, you're an idiot, it was superficial, and sometimes you feel that way. You are required to hit deadlines, and sometimes you don't have enough time, your own accuracy is called into question, and sometimes the fear that I experienced as a graduate student got replaced by certain anxieties as a professional broadcaster. And you can convince yourself that it's not terribly meaningful sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to figure out just for whom this is meaningful. It's not just a process. It should have some kind of impact out there. Otherwise, you could just make films for yourself. Some years back, I made a documentary for television on war photographers. Amazing people. They have amazing stories. And one of these guys, a celebrated photojournalist named James Noctway, hit it for me. He's been to every shithole in the world. He's been applauded and awarded, you know, like you wouldn't believe. And when we interviewed him, I asked him the question, like, is this worthwhile? So let me see if I can get this queued up.
When I went to the orphanages in Romania, it didn't test so much my faith in the value of information and the power of photography as it did my very faith in humanity. This really caused me some moments of despair. I realized that there was no value in giving up. I couldn't do this work if I didn't have hope. I don't put my hope in God or in divine intervention. I put my hope in humanity, because all we have are each other.
Hope is all we have. Hope is all we have. You don't know the impact that you're going to have. It may not be what you want. It may not happen at all. You do know you get nothing if you don't engage. And I think what unites doctoral researchers, academic discourse, broadcast discourse, the activities of my colleagues here on stage, is that you are hoping to have impact. And disengagement is an act of despair. Ultimately, it is a kind of an act of faith. And I think that's where the aperture of possibility that is actually an embodiment reflected here with everybody who's come. That's kind of a personal mantra for me now, is what Noctue said. You stop acting, you stop putting stuff out there, you know nothing will happen. You have to have the hope that by entering into publics, dialogues with different kinds of publics, that things will happen. That's it.
My experience is almost the opposite. I had to be dragged screaming out of academia. When I was first invited to go to Hollywood to work with a friend of mine, I said no. The school year was just beginning. And actually, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife for 30 years, convinced me. She'd been to Los Angeles. I hadn't. Said we should go try it. So I took a year's leave of absence from the university, and then a second year, and then a third year, and then finally I resigned, and they accepted my resignation with amazing alacrity. I was sure they'd beg me to come back, but they figured out by then they could hire someone and pay them less than they were paying me to take over my course. I'm not sure what I have to say is relevant to everybody today, partly because of my age. Whoever said if you got hired at a university in the 70s, your dissertation probably wasn't necessarily that good, they could have been talking about me. I graduated from here, from McGill, and started graduate work at U of T exactly 50 years ago. So it was a long time. And in those days, they begged you to go into graduate school, and they paid you. But by third year of graduate school, I was making more money than anyone I knew, between scholarships and teaching assistants. And in Ontario, you got $2,000 for showing up. By the way, more than anyone I knew was like $6,000, which was plenty of money. I think tuition was $400. My rent was $70. I invested in a movie at one point. The other thing that may make me a little not relevant was, although most of what I know about my profession, besides from practical work, I learned at university, I actually learned it outside my coursework. When I came to McGill, there was a very active film society. And I'm from Fredericton, where there were like two movie theaters, so if you saw every movie, you didn't see very many. And living in Montreal, moving to Montreal in 1961, and belonging to a very active film society, and then getting involved in it was the way I really learned about films. And I read every book that was available, which in those days was four. So we would write notes for the movies. I was an autodidact about film, but I was studying English, which I really enjoyed too. I loved being at the university. And when I went to University of Toronto, I chose courses by two individuals whose names I happened to vaguely have heard of while I was at U of T, Robertson Davies and Marcia McLuhan. And the McLuhan course was called English Literary Criticism. And I took it because I was sort of interested in English literary criticism. And it was in the afternoon, so I could sleep in. It was at St. Mike's. I could walk there. And, of course, it was a little bit about English literary criticism, but it was mainly about McLuhan. And that was really an eye-opener for me. I'd never seen anything quite like it. I've only got 2 minutes left now. So what I'd say of the relevant things that were said here, one of them was about publishing outside academic circles, because in the early, mid-60s and even through the 70s, there were no academic journals about film, and that's what I was most interested in. I worked with the CBC. A friend of mine from the Film Society, again at McGill, started a film magazine called Take One, and that got me into journalism to some extent. So I don't think I've ever published in what might be considered a truly academic journal, partly because there weren't any. So between the CBC and writing for Take One and I think I wrote for the Times Literary Supplement and Canadian Forum. I mean, people here remember Canadian Forum even, and it's sort of a predecessor to The Walrus. But I had the academic credentials because I did manage to get my PhD, and I started a course on film in the what was then called the Extension Department at U of T, using the basis that, well, I had an MA by then. And then because I'd done that, when I was walking across campus one day, and I ran into someone who said, oh, they're looking for someone to teach a film course. They've never given one before at Innes College, which was a relatively new college. So for the decade or so I taught at the University of Toronto, I taught at Innes College. I've never completely... I went to Los Angeles. I got involved in films. I didn't, by the way, produce any of those movies that were listed by myself. I've always worked with other people. And the titles you get on a movie don't necessarily mean much. But I still miss academia in some ways. I've taught a couple of times at UCSB, the University of California in Santa Barbara, which is, I now live in Santa Barbara, which is not actually north of Los Angeles. It's west, believe it or not, where we now have a big oil spill today you've probably been reading about. But I haven't actually found life outside the academy that different. I used to tell this joke when people would say, what's the difference between, you know, Hollywood and academia? And I said, well, there's backbiting and ambition, and then there's Hollywood. And that's really all I think I have to say about it. I think it's really worthwhile to spend as much time in college as you can. I really never wanted to graduate. I thought being a graduate student was one of the greatest things you could do. It was much more fun than going to the Academy Awards. What can I say? Thank you.
Can I use this one? Okay. Hi, I'm Kyle. This is The Walrus. This is what I do all day. This is my my love and my hate all right here. And it was actually just recently, a month ago, that I realized I was no longer aware of the academic calendar, that for the first time in my life, I wasn't thinking about the school year starting or the school year ending. Someone said something to me about track season, and I was like, oh, yeah, it's spring. So my breakup with academia has been long, and it was largely accidental. I went on the market my fifth year of the PhD. I had a complete, fully finished dissertation. I had taught a bunch of classes. I landed MLA interviews. I landed campus interviews. And so those happened in January, February. And then when April rolled around and I submitted my dissertation, I still hadn't heard about the outcome of the shortlists, and I'm an American originally, and my student visa was going to expire because I was now done with school, and I had no idea how I was going to pay rent because I couldn't just go to Starbucks and get a part-time job or something. So I needed a job so that I could get a work visa. So I applied for The Walrus completely naively. I had no idea what I was doing. But I thought perhaps, maybe, just maybe, I would get an interview. And I thought an interview would be practice for more interviews. So I interviewed 3 days before my PhD defense. No, that's not true. I interviewed 5 days before my PhD defense. And then 3 days before my PhD defense, I was offered the job. And then I defended on a Tuesday. And then the next Monday started as the managing editor of The Walrus. I figured I'd do the job for a year, not realizing that every journalist in print, every long-form journalist in the country hated me because I had just gotten this job that a ton of people had applied for, and I had no journalism background. But I thought, I'll do this thing for a year. This is a placeholder. And then when the MLA list comes back out in the fall, I'll look, and I'll apply for jobs. And so I continued publishing, writing academic papers, submitting academic papers, teaching. And then the MLA list came out, and I looked at it for about 3 minutes. I'm like, I don't want to live in any of those places. And now I can't imagine anything but what I'm kind of doing. The PhD did not prepare me for interviewing at a magazine. You don't know what to wear. That was a minor crisis. It certainly did not prepare me for writing a one-page resume, which you need to. I'm hiring an editor right now, and I have to say, even if it's an academic, I look at three-page resumes with complete disinterest. I don't want to read them. So it has to be a one-page resume. PhD didn't teach me anything about libel law, which I spent a lot of time thinking about. It didn't teach me anything about skeptical journalists of this guy that showed up with no journalism background. But the PhD did teach me how to research. It taught me to have confidence in my research and to have confidence that I could find the answer to something that previously I knew nothing about. The other thing that the PhD didn't prepare me for, and this is topical to what we were talking about in the last session, is the speed at which the world outside of academia functions. 10 years, if something has to happen, it happens right away. And the comprehensive exams of the PhD taught me to write quickly when I needed to. So even when I procrastinate and I need to get a piece in the magazine because it's going to ship next week, I know I can get those 800 words written very quickly because I did that in the comps. And the PhD did teach me how to do humanities in public, which I think is why we're here. So the first thing I did, and it's probably the thing I'm still the most proud of that I've done at The Walrus, in addition to winning National Magazine Awards and getting the issue out on time every time, the first thing I did was to decide that all instances of Aboriginal, Native, and Indigenous in relation to people would be capitalized. We were the first mass market publication in Canada to do that. It's an important rhetorical move, and it's a move that we made because of my background as a PhD student. So my advice for PhD students who come and talk to me now in the humanities, who are curious about journalism, who are curious about getting into print or nonprofit cultural work, is to start now. Start while you're in graduate school. No offense to any of the graduate students in here, but you're not as busy as you think. The world outside of academia is way busier. You have way more commitments than you think you'll ever do. It's way more stressful outside of the academy. It's way more complicated. So you have time to write. Write more. Write often. Send in drafts that you don't think are perfect, because that's how it actually works. You receive really bad drafts from Pulitzer Prize winners, and then it's the editor's job to make it better. And stop using 25-cent words. Because you're not impressing anyone. This is the advice I give to people who come to my office and not talk to me. But write clearly, write directly, and write for large audiences. Also, the other thing that I will just say at the closing is you'll be surprised when your committee finds out that you're finding work outside the academy, how supportive they can be, and how excited the department can be for you. So, thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to be very succinct, also because at the preliminary conference in Toronto, I already explained what my project was about. So basically, my story is very simple and straightforward. I came to Canada in 2006, and as a newcomer to Canada, two things immediately struck me as rather odd. The first one was the, I would define as very beautiful, Georgian, Victorian, Edwardian architecture, which is simply allowed to rot away and abandoned in many downtowns. And I immediately wanted to one day work on a project that would at least create awareness about the value of these buildings. And the second thing that struck me as I started working on a PhD in comparative literature was how the university, at least the university I was studying at, seemed to simply turn its back on the city, on the territory where it was situated. I would have expected a university which is landlocked, surrounded by fertile land, to have some kind of a faculty of food nutrition or something of the sort. I would have expected a university that is situated in a city with hospitals which are rather prestigious and looked at with respect nationwide, to have some kind of program about medical history. And nothing of the sort. So I was wondering why. Why do these universities not connect with their territory? Fast forward to 5 years later. I'm a PhD in my fifth year, comparative literature, no funding, and the job prospects pretty bleak, as I started to discover in my sector. one opportunity a year for which there's a clearly long line of people who want to get there. So I clearly needed to start looking at alternatives. And I knew about the MITx, which, by the way, stands for Mathematics, Information Technology, and Complex Systems. I knew how it works. I knew that because my husband, which is why we came to Canada, my husband actually leads a research and development team in a local industry. And I knew how the engineering actually team up with the academia, how they have one postdoc after another, how it's a win-win situation because the industry puts half the money and that money is matched by MITx, so they don't have to put all the money. And the academia, clearly, you have freshly minted PhDs who get the opportunity to work for 2 years on a research project. So I said, look at that model. It's perfect. Why don't we use it in the arts and humanities? And why shouldn't I try to use that model to create a project about heritage buildings, to create awareness about it, to bring people to tell their stories about these buildings, how important they are, and why we should care about them, why we should revitalize this historic core of the city, which stands for a whole community. So how did I go about it? The first person that I actually talked to about this was my husband. And he said, MITx for the arts. Where's your math? Where are your complex systems? MITx will never fund the arts. So I said, but is it just for STEM? He didn't know. So I said, give me the contact of the MITx representative. I contacted her. I met with her. We sat down. I started explaining what I wanted to do. And she actually jumped on me. She said, we've been trying to create projects, MITx projects for the arts and humanities. So, you know, I had been 5 years hearing about cuts, and this year there's less than last year, and 1 year after another there's no more funding. So here was somebody who's saying, it's a funding body, we want to fund the arts. So at that point, I clearly said, follow that money, and of course, follow your passion. So I started working on bringing this project together. At the time, I was doing a part-time job, working, teaching language courses through the Spectrum Project, which was a community-engaged project, courses led by the city. So through that, I knocked on doors, wanted to meet people who were responsible for cultural policy, explained what I wanted to do, asked what were their projects. It turned out that they were working on projects on culture mapping, for which they had engaged consultants from Toronto. I said, why don't we take the cultural mapping project to map out with respect to heritage buildings? And they sort of warmed up to the idea. And then clearly I brought the MITx representative to explain what MITx does. And then there was the other aspect of bringing in the university affiliation. And here again, I was strategic. I chose the University of Guelph because I knew that Guelph has a strong ethos about community-engaged research, and they really do. And the University of Guelph really engages with the territory. It's all about buying local, using local talent, and scouting out there to bring out what the territory has to offer. So the project really found a home through that. And the project clearly came together with all these people, first, of course, writing drafts, and then everyone tweaking, putting in his own input, and finally produced a document which we submitted after roughly a month of peer review. It was approved. So this was the project, a project that clearly brings out the cultural sector and the academy together. I clearly did nothing on a par with what they did, but it seems that, also judging by the level of discussion here, that this is somewhat, it could offer an alternative, it could offer a way forward for the arts and humanities. When I look back at what I learned at PhD and how it was different from this project, I would say that many things were very similar. The ability to be critical, the ability to be creative, to bring a project from A to Z together, to follow it through at every stage, the stamina it takes. There are differences too, because this is a project where you're not simply working single-mindedly, and if you're self-directed enough, you're going to bring it to fruition. You also depend on many other people, so you need to learn to work with other people, not to burn bridges, to be collaborative, and that is something that I definitely learned working on this project. But so many other skills, especially as a researcher, and as a researcher also taking the project from one level to the other until you bring it to fruition, that I definitely, definitely thank all the skills I learned at PhD level. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for your... this on for very entertaining stories. We went from fear and academic love to breakups and money and passion. So I'd like to start off this the conversation by asking you whether we need more PhDs to be employed in the public humanities. And if so, and Kyle touched on this a little bit, how do we encourage students to pursue this area, and how can universities help?
I don't think there's a problem with the number of PhDs being produced, because I was, you know, sitting here quietly for a while. I thought it was time I spoke up again. And I think PhD students need more choices. The kind of constriction I felt that I think is approaches almost universal when you're in that track and you're in that ambivalent zone of finishing, not finishing, and fear on both sides of it, and desire as well to make your mark in some way or other. But knowing that there are viable options out there and indirect applications of what you're doing, I can't claim that there's a direct correspondence between the musculature I developed as a doctoral candidate and what I've been doing as a documentary maker or a broadcaster or what have you. The sheer bloody-mindedness, the commitment to finishing something, get it finished, and that long, dark night of the soul when you have that, I'm never going to finish this thing. I better read another book. You know, I'll publish a paper. I'll do a bit of teaching. You know, anything to stop finishing. You know, if you actually tighten the relationships that the university has with the outside world, which operates in real time with very fast deadlines and so on, but to know that there are interesting, viable, productive, meaningful choices out there, or at least avenues. It's not room service. You just order it up and it's there. But that it's okay. It's okay. You are not a failure if you don't get an academic position. And nor does it have to be just, oh, I didn't want to do that anymore. That you can springboard off of one into the other. It doesn't have to lead to an academic post. And if the consciousness were perhaps more exercised, more present during the doctoral years, it might alleviate a great deal of anxiety and provoke some really interesting relationships between the corporate media, et cetera, world, and what's happening inside the academy.
I don't think there's ever too many PhDs, as long as they don't expect to get a job in the at the university. Though there would probably also be more jobs at the university if the university stopped relying on part-time people. But I think the one thing, by the way, which is all through North America, obviously, the one thing that could be done for graduate students is to try to keep them with a foot in the rest of the world. The world does move at a different speed. It's hard because, you know, even 50 years ago, people were having mental problems trying to finish their doctorate, trust me. I mean, all my friends went through the same things kids are going through now. And but doing things in the outside, the other world at the same time, not all disciplines, you know, lend themselves to that, I realize. But any way it can be done, the way the world can be allowed into the university and the graduate students especially can be in the world a bit, I think is very helpful.
I think that, it doesn't matter how many PhDs there are. It matters the type of environment that a PhD student is in. I think it's remarkable the reaction that I had from my committee. I knew my chair would be fine with it, but I was petrified of my other two members, and they were both thrilled when I finally told them immediately after the defense. I was amazed by the reaction of my department. I held up convocation when the president and the chancellor wanted to talk to me about the walrus as I was getting my diploma. They were really excited. But none of that excitement was present while we were doing, my cohort was going through. None of us knew that this was okay. None of us knew that this would be exciting. So that needs to change. And that's the sort of change that doesn't take 10 years. That takes 10 minutes. And I think that that's the sort of thing that an individual professor can help start that. But the other thing is, a department needs to teach people, if they're going to be in both worlds, or to even have the opportunity of being both worlds, they need to teach people how to write a cover letter for a non-academic position. It's not the same thing as writing a cover letter for a teaching position. You need to know how to write a resume that's one page that doesn't have PhD at the top. You need to know whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing to put PhD after your name. And those are things that don't require institutional change. That just requires a department or an individual professor's commitment to reach out to people in the business sector to come in and teach you how to write a one-page resume. And those are sorts of things that help even if you want to stay in the academy.
I do think the number of PhDs should be restricted, but I do think that the PhD should be rethought. Having said that, I don't agree that the part to touch should be the dissertation. I think the dissertation is really that big occasion where you can show that you are an original thinker. It's a formative experience, and I learned so much from it. I think what should be rethought is from day one, from the very first year, that there are projects, faculty-led projects, which connect to the cultural sector, which students can actually spend a semester working on a portion of such research, be paid, for example, through MyTax. It's good money also. And in that way, also network. And like that, you're not creating a two-tier system, you know? Everyone is doing this, and everyone is getting the opportunity to network, and eventually, some will get some opportunities, others will get others, and it's a win-win situation, I would say.
I agree. The dissertation that I remember when I finished, somebody said who had just done it, it wasn't that a pig, like at the end of it, but getting the pig wrestled to the ground, to just milk that metaphor dry, that's a skill. It sounds crude, but being able to get on top of that, I think that is something that has stayed with me, because trust me, when you're in the middle of a documentary and somebody's dropped out or your editing system has cacked out again, that in much higher speed, that long dark night of the soul gets repeated. So, but that rite of passage of wrestling that thing to the ground and getting on top of it, and you know, that cliche, what was it? Don't get it right, get it written. That was enormously helpful to me at one point. Get it written. Don't read another damn book. Get it written. And now the applause that happened just a minute ago on the issue of part timing, my colleague and mentor at CBC Radio, Ira Basin, in the autumn did a documentary that many of you have probably heard about, the scandal, really, of part-timing in the university. Ira would not have done that documentary unless he had been teaching part-time himself at Ryerson, Western, and so on, a few of these places, and got to experience firsthand what the whole thing is like, to observe as a journalist, but also to experience it more or less as people are coming up through the system, which leads me to think that, to go and just milk that metaphor, to hogtie the relationship of people who are in other avenues, professional avenues, back into the classroom again as a guest speaker, perhaps to do some tandem teaching. I know iPlay, I know you guys are experimenting with that format and so on. Get creative about hardwiring the relationship between people who are out there and students and candidates who are in here. And again, you don't know what's going to accrue from that. But I am certain that Ira would not have made that documentary had he not been stuck in that, had he not walked that walk the way so many people are feeling trapped in right now.
And on a similar topic then, Greg, what you mentioned, and all of you have kind of mentioned in terms of keeping a foot both in the academic world and beyond, what are some of the concrete things that universities can do to create better connections, to create better networks between the research and the teaching that's happening and between Hollywood or journalism or culture and cities, urban planning?
This sounds really simple. It's a concrete thing that I was thinking about yesterday. I get invited to a lot of alumni, like networking things at U of T, or come back to the department, or come back to the College of Arts and Sciences, and they're always at night. A really concrete thing to do is have all those events in the morning. It's a lot easier for somebody, at least in my line of work, to make an 8 a.m. Obligation months in advance and to commit to it than it is to do a 7 p.m. because production cycles get in the way, other things get in the way, interview opportunities come up. That's just a really simple thing to engage journalists or the business world with breakfasts. And you see a lot of fundraisers doing breakfasts instead of afternoon stuff or evening stuff. It's just simply easier to get people in the door.
I get awfully tired of my old college asking me for money. I'm not giving it to them. They have enough, or what they need, they're not going to get from me, that's for sure. Look where I work. But my point is that that Perimeter Institute, the Physics Institute in Waterloo, for example, they do amazing things. And I produced the first CBC radio interview that Mike Lazaridis did. He was the benefactor. You know, he went through, got physics as an undergrad, fell in love with physics, made his fortune in .com, and decided, I want to do something good in this world. And so he got it kickstarted. And he's still involved heavily in it. And Neil Turok, the director, was a Massey lecturer for Ideas. So we've kept up a kind of working relationship. And I had spent the last 8 years out of the country. It was 3 years at NPR in the States, and then went to Radio Netherlands. So I was in Amsterdam for 5. Got back a year and a half ago. And last June, I went to Perimeter for the first time. And if I had a degree in physics, I'd want to work there. It's amazing. They bring disparate, even philosophically inimical points of view and schools of thought together in the one house, and there's all kinds of space to talk. The architecture facilitates that as well. It's just, if you've never been, go at some point. It's just wonderful. And so by sitting down in the morning and having some very frank discussions about the kind of programming I'm looking for, which is not to reproduce the complexities of their discourse. I want to speak and engage in a peer-adult relationship with educated lay people who can understand English. That's where the bar is. That there's a lot of taxi cab drivers in Toronto are big Ideas listeners. I believe people are generally underserved by electronic media, hence the popularity of, you know, John Oliver, John Stewart, and so on and so on and so on. People in my line of work are largely, you know, in electronic media at any rate, across the board have failed the public in many ways, I would suggest. But it's redeemable. And there are all kinds of institutes, like I say, Perimeter, for example, is having those conversations and seeing where it goes. Just seeing where it goes. If you find people are doing really interesting things, talk to them. And you can start to build the relationships. And again, not knowing that all the outcomes are foreseeable, but now, because of that one lunch a year ago, Paul Kennedy, the host, and I are going to go to Perimeter for a couple of days, I think in June, and working with Perimeter beforehand, we'll know exactly who we want to interview them on our own terms, and it will become a couple of programs, a couple of hours worth. And it's cheap.
The only thing I can think of is find excuses to send students out into the world, which I can't think of many. And the other one is perhaps to give a bit of credit for work done in the world. In other words, I never wrote for scholarly publications because I'm lying a bit. There was one the British Film Institute had a magazine called Screen, which was probably the first. It introduced, I think before English departments did, Lacan and Foucault and semiology to the English-speaking world. Interestingly enough, all the people who worked for it, none of them had jobs at universities. They're all poor freelance intellectuals. I was friendly with several of them. And they all got jobs rather late in their life, like about 10 years ago. These are people my age. Suddenly in their late 40s and 50s, they started to get university jobs, which was a little strange. By which time, we were all over the hill, of course. But anyway, all I can think of is sending students out into the world and accepting work done in the world that may not be, you know, vetted by peers at the university.
As I said, I think actions speak louder than words. It's not enough for faculty to say we support you if you want to pursue a career outside academia. I think the faculty should set the example by creating these projects, collaborating with the outside world. If we are, of course, PhD in the humanities, we're such critical thinkers, ability to think laterally, to be creative, then we are able to create them. I'm sure of that. And this would help so much the students who would, from the very first year of their PhD, start thinking on these terms without the guilt.
Thank you. So I think we'll open it up to questions from the floor. I think there are two traveling mics again. So just wave if you have a question. Otherwise, I will just keep asking them. There in the back.
Hi.
Go ahead. Just it's more of a plea, I guess. It's a message for Greg. Hi, I'm Rista Goble from SHRC. And when you do your stories with the Perimeter Institute, a plea to connect with humanities faculty. The Perimeter Institute reached out to the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony Orchestra, and they've been touring the country with a connection of music and history and literary studies and the connection to physics in terms of in a historical context, certainly in terms of how the study of physics has really brought forward critical thinking. And there's a real great parallel with scholarly research in the humanities, and it would be great to invite some humanities scholars to participate in that series.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because we're already doing it. My colleagues back at Ideas, there's a new format we've developed called Ideas from the Trenches, where they solicit and get very compelling, very interesting doctoral research done at a university in Canada by a particular person. They brief themselves on it and then take the baton, as it were, and run with it and interview, try to forward the whole thing and check in. So the doctoral candidate, in a way, becomes the judge of what the two producers are doing along the way, and then they get together at the end of it as well. And these colleagues were just in Ottawa at Impact at a SHRC event. Paul Kennedy was there as well, and Paul had spoken publicly a few times, but now we're looking at content generation. So the wheel is just starting to get turned.
So on this point of the difference in speed between how work is done in the academic world and how it's done everywhere else, and particularly sort of in this vein of Ideas from the Trenches, where there's this ongoing translation of academic work into a more broadcast suitable medium. Do you have any sort of quick and dirty tricks for people who are thinking about the research they're doing academically and are wondering at what level, in what aspects, what sort of hooks can be useful to take stuff that is interesting in an academic sense but needs to be massaged to really meet the public conversation where it is, or helpfully take half a step ahead and bring it in a certain direction?
I'm going to take my cue from Kyle on this. I think, you know, one thing, and Joe, you know, credit for work that may appear outside of the academy, which is not to disparage, you know, I'm profoundly ambivalent about the professional ideologues that I was immersed in the late 80s. But that is not to say that academic discourse doesn't have its place. Of course it does, right? But it's not the only language that can be spoken. So, but if there were a way to credit people, if they publish an article in Queen's Quarterly or The Walrus or what have you, you know, then you will encounter the kind of tricks. Rather than give you kind of a primer on what I'm, you know, my bag of tricks and stuff, you know, I think to try and step out before the doctorate is done during that, because if it's really interesting, if it's occupying that much of your life, well, presumably you have an interest or a passion in it, and if you don't, then maybe it's time to pack it in. But if it is a passion, if it is of interest to you, well, there's a very strong likelihood that it will be of interest to other people if it's framed in an appropriate manner. And so write the first draft, send it on spec, you know, imitate techniques of non-academic but thoughtful, interesting, deep thinkers that you like. Edward Said was a broadcaster's dream. He had the depth and the scholarly background to make his claims on, you know, certain, let's say, literary history, intellectual history viable. He was connected to events of the day, of course, and he knew his audiences. He knew when to change gears, so he could go into that specialized vocabulary at MLA conferences, or if you produced a CBC interview with him, he could just speak as he would if he were surrounded by his own peers. So I would say, take the leap, start to think in those terms already, and then contact the places that you're already interested in. If you like reading various kinds of magazines, contact people like Kyle, contact people like me, and then see where it goes. But take the initiative. Think of yourselves as a media producer, and the tricks and so on will start to fall into place rather than the other way around.
Sorry, I'm grabbing everything. two pieces of advice about that. One is from Ira Glass, who I don't know if you know him here, does a radio show, and he has recently written a thing where he said, the way you get to do good work is you do bad work first.
Oh, that 1 minute thing?
Yeah, you know, do, and the other side of that was something when we had this little film magazine, we had to sell advertising to support it. And Peter Levinsohn, who was editing it, and myself would drive around town and try to sell advertising. And some, we were reasonably successful enough to keep it going for a while. And someone said to us, well, what percentage of turndowns are you getting? And we'd say, oh, you know, 5 or, you know, I don't know, 20% of the people turn us down. And he said, well, you're not trying hard enough. You should be getting 50%, 60% turndowns. In other words, don't be afraid to fail. And you're a little bit coddled at the university until you have to do your dissertation. And there is that thing of try things, and if you're rejected by the walrus, send it to someone else. Or try to write something else for them. In the university, there's sort of, you're allowed one failure, and I guess, and then they throw you out. The world at large allows you a lot of failures, and you shouldn't be afraid of them.
For me, I mean, part of my job is to meet with people who have ideas and don't know how to get them into the magazine. So you email editors and you ask to buy them a coffee, and they're going to be more than happy to talk to you. The other thing that is really, really important, extremely important when you're trying to convey an idea that you're developing in the humanities to a popular audience is to remember that a 5,000-word seminar paper is a snooze fest, and that you can actually accommodate and accomplish a really sophisticated argument in 1,000 words if you put yourself to that task, and if you have an editor who's going to force you to write to 800 words. Like a magazine article, a long New Yorker piece, maybe is 10,000 words, and those are extremely rare. The longest piece that we've had in The Walrus since I've been there is, was 2 words short of 10,000 words. It was on Jason Kenney. It was by Marcy McDonald. It took her 3 years to write that piece. But that's extremely rare. And you get these pitches from people who are writing a dissertation or writing a book, and they are proposing a 5,000-word essay on a piece of, you know, art that no one's ever heard of. We're not going to publish that, but we might publish an 800-word piece about that piece of art. So to remember that you can convey a lot of information that the general public is going to find really fascinating in less time than you're used to just writing your introduction.
Other questions? Okay, well, maybe we'll just end on one last question that I had. About impact, which Greg was something that you mentioned at the beginning, but I think is something that came out in each one of your talks and the ensuing conversation. And you're all obviously incredibly passionate about what you do now. And I'm curious to know if you think your sense of impact, your sense of accomplishment, your passion for what you're currently doing, whether that's something you would have also discovered. Had you stayed within the academic environment, and actually maybe Joe, having spent 10 years at FIRST within the academic environment, is maybe well positioned to talk about you know, both of those cases. But I leave it open to all of you for a couple last words on the subject.
To be honest, I don't think about it much. I have a lot of friends who write novels write books that sell 400 copies, and they're really good. I have friends in academia who write papers that are read by, you know, their peers, and nothing I do in Hollywood will ever have the impact Marshall McLuhan had, for example, who, though mind you, he's an example of someone who loved, I mean, his favorite thing was being in a Woody Allen movie. So, I mean, there is that side of it, too, that people do. But, you know, the impact you can have with 800 incredibly passionate readers or audience, I mean, if you're a performer, an audience of 800 is really big. Unfortunately, I'm in a business, when I first got to Hollywood, and it was when people were first starting to talk about independent films, and people would say, well, are you involved in independent films? I'd say, no, I'm involved in very dependent films. They're dependent on millions of people going to see them. But it's just as exciting. You can get, I would actually argue, you can get the thrill out of, you know, the kind of positive feedback and reinforcement by doing something that 800 people really like and appreciate?
There are different kinds of impact. And, you know, whether your aggregate audience is 1.25 million each week, happens to be ideas, numbers alone can't measure the kind of impact either. And I wish some of our senior managers, David, would get this point. It's not just the number of mobile clicks. It's the relationship you have with your listeners. So if all we want are numbers, well, let's run porn. It's not that hard, you know, or some stupid cat video. It's not that hard, you know, and who cares? The stuff, the ephemera comes and goes. I actually like some of the cat videos, but they're not very impactful. They're nice little breaks, and everybody needs a break now and then. One of the most gracious men I've ever met in my life is a poet, an Irish guy named Bernard O'Donoghue, who was at Oxford, and I bumped into the subject of my dissertation was Oscar Wilde, so you kind of bump into the Irish crowd, the Anglo-Irish crowd after a while. And Bernard was just starting to publish poetry in the major poetry publications in the UK. And after I got back to Canada, he won the Whitbread Prize and so on, and he got the opportunity to do a little less teaching because he was gaining more and more prominence as a poet. And he decided to keep up his teaching load. And Bernard said that it was a privilege to teach. It was a privilege to come into contact with young minds, not just because of youthful energy and, you know, it's easy to get cynical as you get older. That's true. That was all good. But rather, there's nothing like getting on top of the feeling or the interest that you have in this or that than when you have to present it, when you actually have to communicate that. And that's a very strong point of resemblance between what we do and what you do. That there's nothing like when you have to stand up in front of a class or make a radio or television documentary. Like, what do you mean again? What are you saying? Can you make, you know, the process of clarification and trying to reach and perhaps move people is never finished. So, you know, there is no limit to the context in which impact can be held, I would suggest. There's no limit. There's enough success in that regard to go around.
It is really satisfying to walk down the path in downtown Toronto and pass a newsstand and see the Walrus on in the cover on the newsstand, and or to see somebody on the subway with a Walrus bag or reading the Walrus or something. That's really great. But the most satisfying thing is I think this type of thing that you can do in the classroom as a teacher, and that is to convince a writer who is not confident in what they're writing that it is good, and to convince that writer to keep going, and then to engage with that writer on an edit, and then to have that piece come out and have that writer's name being spoken because of what they wrote. And it's that, you know, as the editor of a piece, you don't get any credit. No one knows who edits what, unless it's the New York Times Magazine. But that's incredibly satisfying. And I think that's the same type of satisfaction I felt when I helped a student who is a C+ work their way up to a B. It's that type of satisfaction that you got when the quiet student in a seminar room spoke up for the first time in class because the loud student said something incredibly rude or disrespectful. That satisfaction. So I think it's I wouldn't say it's more or less, but it's the same kind.
So the immediate impact of this project, I would say, is a second project which we are planning, this time for the downtown of Guelph, focusing once more on the heritage and how the waves of different European immigrants actually built that heritage. So that's the immediate impact. Personally, I'm finishing this postdoc and I'm neither employed in the cultural sector, nor do I have a job in academia, so I'm really not in a position to say exactly, to give advice to students. But I did, in the last week, get 2 job interviews, which is something really new, which I didn't get as a PhD in comp lit. So I'm starting to think that a MITAC postdoc can offer really a number of opportunities even within academia, because I started this thinking I'm going to keep 1 foot in academia, 1 foot outside, and probably I'll find employment outside. And now, I think because community-engaged research is all the rage, I actually get interviews
from academia. So I don't know where this is going, but from all the discussion that I've heard these 2 days, I think there is a future for this kind of research.
One last word.
It's another small story. Impact in media tends to be immediate. I guess those words must be related, media and immediate. I guess somebody can look it up. But just because it's not immediate doesn't mean there isn't or won't be impact. You don't know. But the commitment to the process is what counts. William Shatner went through this period of hating everything to do with Star Trek, wouldn't have anything to do with it before the big money came in for the movies some years later. And so he would shut people up, shut them down if people recognized him or wanted an autograph. He could be quite rude when he wanted to be. And I think he was in New York. This isn't a very well-known story. I don't know why it isn't. But he's taking a cab. I think it was New York. And a rather scraggly-looking cab driver looks in the rearview mirror. Oh, you're and he thought, oh, Jesus, here we go. And you're Captain Kirk, aren't you? Yeah. You know, and he said, you saved my life. And Shatner, what? Yeah, you saved my life. Yeah, I'm a Vietnam vet. And I got captured. And it was awful. And they did things to us. And when you're in those cages with the other guys, and you don't know them, but you're mosquitoes, and you're hungry, and you get beaten, and worse, we kept our sanity by acting out little bits of Star Trek that we knew. And it was the only way to keep ourselves sane. And we did that. Oh, here's your stop. Thanks. And Shatner's there on the sidewalk going, he's just dumbfounded. Just because you don't know what the impact is doesn't mean that there won't be one.
Beautiful story by which to end it. Thank you, and thank you to all four of you for a really engaging, insightful conversation filled with a lot of humor. And I'd encourage you all, I think we have a 15-minute break again, encourage you all to come down to continue the conversation either now or after the very last session when I believe there's a trip to the pub. So thank you again, and thank you to our panelists.